This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Trump administration appears to regard diplomacy in a different light as compared to other administrations. We hear from one longtime U.S. diplomat about that and specifically about this nation's work in West Africa later in the program. First, Mecklenburg County was hit by a ransom attack this week. An email attachment opened by a county worker unleashed spyware and a worm into the county's computer system, locking key files. The hacker demanded $23,000 to unlock those files, with no guarantee that once the money was paid, the files would in fact be unlocked. County Manager Dina DiOrio decided not to pay the ransom, and she made the New York Times because of it. The New York Times writes, "In a world rocked by hackers, trolls, and online evildoers of all stripes, the good people of the internet have looked for a hero who would refuse to back down. Finally, someone has said enough is enough, and that someone is the government of Mecklenburg County, North Carolina," which of course includes the city of Charlotte. Well, that someone is actually Dina DiOrio, the county manager, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Good morning.
So when and how did the county first become aware of this? How does it happen? Is it like the movies?
Well, it sort of is like the movies. Our IT team actually found some activity and traffic on our systems that indicated some kind of ransomware. And then it is like the movies. Somebody opened up an application and there was actually a ransom note. So we knew that we actually were in the midst of a ransomware attack.
And the note says what?
It says that your information is locked, and they give you instructions on sort of what the next steps are in terms of what the process is to get your files and your servers
unlocked. And they tell you how much they want.
They tell you how much they want.
How much did they want?
Two Bitcoin.
Two Bitcoins. Of course, the value of Bitcoin changes hourly, it seems. It's like a stock. And you had until 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon to decide whether or not you were going to comply. That deadline came and went, and it wasn't until late in the afternoon. So how did you know you could even pay the Bitcoins at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock when you finally made a decision not to pay the Bitcoin?
Well, we needed to respond back to them by 1 o'clock, not actually pay the ransom, but actually make contact with them. So we had made contact with them prior to 1 p.m., so they believed that we were in the process of doing what we needed to do.
How
do
you make contact with them?
We hired a third-party cyber firm that actually made contact with them on our behalf. They sent an email. And actually what they did was they sent an email first making pretend that they were another victim of the same ransomware attack to get a sense of what the hackers would want. And then they made a request on our behalf to find out what they were going to want in exchange for the two Bitcoin.
Right, so they essentially gave you an extension? Is that what they did? They said you can wait? Or how did that work?
Well, the conversation was ongoing. So as long as the conversation was ongoing, I think they believed that we were actually ultimately going to pay.
Now, according to the paper this morning, you suspect that this attack originated in the Ukraine or in Iran, one of the two. Why do you suspect that?
Well, the cybersecurity firm that we worked with looked at the ransomware, and the attributes of that were similar to a different type of ransomware.
You mean the metadata? Or what do you mean attributes? What does that mean?
It means what it sort of looks like. I mean, it's a long string of things, and you know, the technical part is not my sweet spot.
Okay, but
apparently the attributes of that look similar to other ransomware that does originate either in Iran or the Ukraine.
Hmm. We're going to talk a little bit about this with our next guest, who has experience with this all over the world. But you decided not to pay. Now, first of all, before we talk about the implications of not paying, what exactly happened? Evidently, it was described as the county being crippled. Its computer system was crippled. Are you saying countywide, all the computers are down?
No, we have certain applications. Let me take a step back. Once we realized that we had a ransomware situation, the firm that we were working with told us that you need to shut everything down so it doesn't spread. So part of the reason some of our systems are down is because we actually took them down on purpose so that we could make sure that they didn't get infected. And so we do have certain systems that are down, but we are able to provide services using alternate means of service. So we are using paper files. And some of our applications are running on some servers that are not impacted, so we can provide some level of service.
Everybody who has email gets weird stuff in their email almost every single day. This happened because a county worker opened an attachment to an email that appeared to have come from another county worker, which legitimizes a reason why you might open the attachment. But everybody also knows, I think maybe everybody doesn't know, emails can be spoofed. They can appear to come from somebody that they do not come from, and that, in fact, is what this was. How could you have protected yourself from this? Is there any way that you could have?
Well, one of the things that we're going to be looking at once we sort of move forward to the next step is actually how it got into our system in the first place. I think your firewalls are your greatest protection from this ransomware getting into your system. So what we're looking for now is what they call patient zero, which is the initial element that actually got into our computer, where it really started.
Did it have to come from the internet? Could it have come from a thumb drive? Could it have come from something that somebody brought in?
I think it can. I think it can come from multiple different sources. So we really want to figure out how it got in, how that happened, and try to protect ourselves in the future. Because as you say, people say don't open emails from people you don't know. Well, in this case, they open an email from somebody who they thought they did know. So it's very difficult for employees to be able to make a distinction, and that's why we really need to understand how it got into the first place.
The county has to open emails from people they don't know. That's just the nature of the business.
Well, that is true as well.
And sometimes there are attachments to those emails that are legitimate.
And this one apparently had a Google attachment, which is something that people would recognize.
So you mentioned firewalls. What kind of security software or antivirus or malware or phishing software does the county have installed? Do you know?
I don't know specifically, but
I know that you have it.
We absolutely do have it. And since I've been county manager, we have invested in a number of different tools as it relates to IT security to do whatever we can to try to make sure that we're secure.
So $23,000 or 2 bitcoins, whatever it's worth this hour, for Mecklenburg County is not all that much money. Of course, there was no guarantee, as I said at the top, that even if you paid the ransom, that they would unlock the files, or that permanent damage to those files would not be ongoing, or a worm might continue crawling through the system even after you pay and they unlock the files. So that's one of the things that you had to weigh. What would it have cost you if you had paid the ransom in addition to unlocking the files? You'd have to do a sweep of your systems. What would that have cost, and how does that cost compare to what you'll have to do now to rebuild everything?
So you're right. If you're successful in getting the encryption key and you're able to unlock your files, you still have to do a complete sweep of all of your infrastructure to make sure there's nothing else hiding in there. So that takes some number of days. And so we believe that by not paying the ransom and rebuilding the systems by ourselves, it will take us some number of more days, but we don't think it's significantly more than it would be if we had bought the ransomware.
How much will it cost?
I think it's more about staff time than it is about actual dollars, because it really is a manual process. They have to manually sweep every server.
So what was affected? Everything is down now because you've turned off all the computers to protect yourself. But what files were locked and directly impacted by this ransomware?
So we know that we had our Izzy system was impacted. That's our child welfare system. That was one that we know that was impacted. OnBase, which is our electronic document system, which everybody in the county uses, was impacted. Our ability to print documents has been impacted. And a number of other applications that we use have been impacted.
So what are you doing?
We are providing services to the residents of North Carolina using alternate means as we can. We've been able to hook up laptops outside the network to be able to do work. We have been, I have to say that the employees of Mecklenburg County have been incredibly resourceful, and they have been incredibly creative to be able to continue operations as normal, even if they are a little bit hampered.
And you're confident that the backups, your electronic backups, are not infected?
That's correct. We've gone ahead and tested some of our backup data. We've loaded it and seen if it does actually work. So we've been able to test that, and that was a key decision for us to make sure the backup data was clean and that it can be restored. And now that we know that was also a big consideration in our decision to not pay.
Initial reports about exactly what data was affected, in those reports you said that hackers did not have access to people's health records, social security numbers, or credit card information.
Well, what we said was we did not, based on what we saw, that information had not been compromised. So
how can you be sure?
Because they can tell whether or not data has been taken or changed. In this case, they know the data has been locked, the servers have been locked, but no data has been taken or changed. And that's then they can tell that by the tools that they use to look at it.
So what's the prognosis and the time for recovery? When do you think you'll
be back? Well, the prognosis is very, very strong. We are confident that we can get all of our systems restored, but we do think it will be 2 to 3 weeks before everything is back online. But understand, things will come back online incrementally over that time.
This happens almost every day, everywhere, in every kind of organization. And this is a criminal activity, and it's being criminally investigated, but they never find these people, do they?
Well, it's really difficult to find people. And I would say that I wouldn't say that it's being criminally investigated. We have consulted with a series of law enforcement agencies, but as far as I know, there is no active case right now to try to find these perpetrators.
When do you think you'll be 100% up and running again?
Well, we're hopeful by the new year we will have everything up and running.
Dina DiIorio, county manager, the savior, the person who said enough is enough, according to the New York Times. Thank you for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about this happening all around the world and how it impacts national security, among other things, with a former member of the U.S. Diplomatic Corps. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Under the Trump administration, our approach to diplomacy seems to be changing. Hundreds of positions within the State Department have gone unfilled nearly a year into Trump's presidency, even as career diplomats have left the Foreign Service. We're going to get our guests this hour's take on that. Todd Moss has extensive experience in international diplomatic affairs in West Africa and was once the top U.S. diplomat there. That continent has one of the fastest growing economies in the world, but suffers from food insecurity, a lack of electricity, and access to clean water, among other concerns. And one nation, Zimbabwe, faces significant changes with the fall of Robert Mugabe. The U.S. can have a role in helping them to recover, and Moss calls it vital. Todd Moss is now senior fellow at the Center for Global Development, focused on U.S.-Africa relations, and he's in town to speak at the World Affairs Council Charlotte lunch, for which there are still seats available. You can go to World Affairs Council Charlotte, worldaffairscharlotte.org, and find out. But Dr. Moss is also a novelist who has embarked on a series of books featuring the State Department's Experimental Crisis Reaction Unit, headed by protagonist Judd Riker. Of course, this series must be based on Todd Moss's own experience, so we'll talk about that and many other things for the rest of this hour. Welcome to Charlotte and to the program.
Great, Mike.
Let's start with something I had not thought we would talk about, and that is a dovetailing with our conversation a moment ago with Dina DiIorio, the county manager. In your latest book, The Shadow List, it deals with something kind of related to what we were just talking about, with an internet scheme that we're all familiar with, this email from a Nigerian prince saying you've come into money, or from somebody from the Ukraine, a Russian oligarch, saying you've come into money. And in your book, your protagonist works for the State Department. His wife works for the CIA. Is this autobiographical?
Absolutely not.
Okay. and she tells him the world is messy and dangerous, more dangerous than you know. Does that mean that computers hooked up to the internet are more dangerous than we know?
Well, I think you've answered that this morning with the guest before me. You know, when you think about foreign policy and international diplomacy, you're normally talking about government-to-government relations. Are we going to do trade deals? What problems are we going to solve? You're talking about high policy at the 10,000-foot level. But in thinking about what diplomatic issue I wanted to deal with in my latest book, I had been really reflecting on the extent to which international criminal networks are pervasive and are touching our lives every day. And the Nigerian prince email scheme is sort of something everyone gets. I think people wonder, who's really behind that? Is this a Nigerian teenager in an internet cafe? Well, probably not. It's actually an international criminal organization. Something closer to The Sopranos than to just a kid hacker. And that is touching everyone's lives. And the more I thought about that, the more I was thinking about how kidnapping is touching more and more lives, how trafficking in drugs, in guns, in people are touching more and more people's lives, and how that's actually really affecting U.S. national security.
You didn't mention nation states. Just because it's a Russian oligarch doesn't mean it's connected to the Russian government necessarily, but it could be. Are you saying that China and Russia and North Korea and other rogue states could actually have departments in their government doing these things?
Well, in lots of places, the line between the state and private actors is not as clear as we'd like it to be. Even in the, you know, in the country I work a lot in Nigeria, there's no Nigerian government hacking group, but there are international, there are Nigerian organized crime networks that have connections into the government, and sometimes that line can get a little hazy.
And you say it's not just emails or ransomware like the county just experienced, it's kidnapping. And you say, you just said a second ago, that this is now beginning to affect U.S. national security. In what way?
Well, you know, I noticed I'm a big baseball fan. I live in Washington, D.C. The Washington Nationals are my team. And a couple of summers ago, our catcher, who was from Venezuela, went home on the offseason, was kidnapped for ransom. And this kind of shocked Washington, D.C. But since that's happened, I've actually known several people who've had family members kidnapped for ransom around the world. And if you look at some of the terror groups that were that the United States is fighting around the world, like in West Africa, the way that the Al-Qaeda and ISIS-type groups in West Africa make money is by kidnapping people for ransom. A Canadian diplomat was kidnapped for ransom. They kidnap private citizens. They kidnap locally wealthy people. And this is really becoming a major international problem.
Theoretically speaking, or officially speaking, the U.S. does not pay ransom. It doesn't deal with terrorists. Other governments do. In governments that do cooperate and do pay these ransoms, are the people returned unharmed, or are they just kept?
Yeah, very often they are returned because they're trying, you know, these kidnappers actually want to try to create a profitable business. And if you're not delivering, you're not going to be able to get future ransoms. So unfortunately, that system kind of feeds itself.
Is the United States rock solid on that policy, or do things happen that we don't know behind the scenes?
Well, I think, look, I haven't been in government for several years, so I couldn't comment on current policy. The U.S. government would not be involved in any of that. However, private citizens, if your child was kidnapped and you felt that paying a ransom was going to save your child's life, the U.S. government would probably dissuade you from doing that because of policy, but they could not stop you from doing that.
I see. And because this is a threat to national security, do we have apparatus in place, such as the CIA, the FBI, other organizations, or even an organization devoted specifically to these things? Are they strong? Are they effective? Are the protections working?
Well, look, the United States has a lot of capability, particularly to track money, but we are not the world's policemen. We cannot go into every corner, and these criminal organizations operate in the far corners of the earth. So that means that we have to work with local law enforcement. In Nigeria, is a good example. We have the United States government has a great relationship with the local law enforcement authorities, and we also have to figure out which ones can we work with and which ones can we not.
When most of us think of terrorism and terrorist acts, we think of people flying airplanes into buildings and killing innocent people on the streets with automobiles or with guns, etc. Would this be classified as terrorism, the kidnapping and ransomware and other forms of non-traditional means of doing harm?
Well, look, I think the important piece here is that a lot of the terror networks, the groups that are seeking to set off bombs and to attack civilians to create fear among the population, the way that they gain resources is largely through criminal activities. The Taliban is involved in international opium trade. You've got groups, you know, the kidnapping groups in South America, in West Africa, in parts of the South China Sea. So, you know, you're seeing this intersection of terror groups and international criminal groups in a way that sometimes those lines blur very, very, very clearly.
Dr. Todd Moss is currently senior fellow at the Center for Global Development. He's a former deputy assistant secretary in the Bureau of African Affairs in the U.S. State Department, I believe under the George H.W. Bush.
George W. Bush, that's right.
Administration not too long ago. There are concerns in some circles that President Trump is hollowing out the diplomatic corps or is ignoring the diplomatic corps in some way. Hundreds of positions evidently have gone unfilled. Other senior longtime members of the diplomatic corps have been leaving. He has not filled some ambassadorships, including the ambassador of South Korea, which is seems to me to be fairly important at this time of our existence. Regarding North Korea, he seems to favor the military might over diplomacy. The same could be said of other hotspots around the world. And now he has announced just yesterday that he intends to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv over time to Jerusalem. And people around the world, including people in the Middle East, say this could seriously upset the balance of power in the region and set off a series of conflicts and a rise in terrorist activity. As someone who formerly worked in the State Department, what is your take on all of this?
Well, I think, you know, in the immediate term, it is very disappointing that so many positions, so many very senior decision-making positions are vacant. In my own area, there is no Assistant Secretary for Africa. So right now, you mentioned Zimbabwe at the top of the list. That position would be the person that would be running point on what should the United States be doing there. If there is a major incident, you normally would rely on the regional expert who's leading both the State Department but also across the agencies for a U.S. response. So many of those positions are just empty right now.
So what's the impact of that?
Well, it means that the United States is not proactive. We're not responding in ways that are most effective for meeting our own national security or our economic interests. We're very passive. But I think the bigger problem is that those positions will eventually be filled. The bigger problem is that we're seeing a real bias away from and a denigration of the civilian capabilities of the government. I don't think there's any question that the State Department could use reform. When I worked there, there's a lot of dysfunction and a lot of inefficiency. Absolutely, it could be reformed. But what we're actually seeing is kind of mindless hacking and disregard for the role of diplomacy in promoting U.S. interests.
But as the president, I think, said just yesterday, that it's you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And he said yesterday that so far, with regard to Israel, everybody recognizes that Jerusalem is already the capital and that it was inevitable that this had to happen. And not having it happen all these years in the hope that peace would break out has not been successful. So maybe this will jar something loose and cause peace to happen in this way. Is he necessarily wrong?
Well, I don't think that there are very many people that have followed Middle East affairs for a long time that would share that view. But I think the bigger question here is whether the United States, we have major interests around the world. We count on our government to protect us, to help create economic opportunities for American companies and workers, and to respond to things like humanitarian crisis around the world. And we are moving in a direction where the military is the only capable arm that we have to do that, and that's extremely dangerous.
You, as I said, when you were at the State Department, you centered on your attention was centered on West Africa. You are still centered on Africa in your work as a senior fellow for the Center for Global Development. Africa has significant challenges, but Africa is a continent, not a country. And a lot of people don't know that.
That's right.
There are 54 fully recognized sovereign nations at last count on that continent. So how does this kind of work proceed, given all the jurisdictions that have to be respected?
Well, you know, I think a lot of Americans still think of Africa as something, you know, from the 1980s that they saw late night famine ads, and right. They think that it's just a disaster. That really, you know, couldn't be further from the truth. You know, it's a very diverse place, 54 countries. Many of those countries are racing ahead into the future. Countries that we would normally, that Americans normally think of in relation to corruption or war or famine, like Ethiopia or Nigeria or Rwanda, which experienced a horrible genocide only a little more than 20 years ago, are actually rapidly modernizing. Their economies are growing. People are becoming wealthier, and they're becoming to come back to our talk about international criminal networks, these are our allies that our government has to work with in that region. And so really Africa is on the move. I visit all the time. I'm based in Washington, but I'm there all the time. And literally every time I get off the plane, things look different.
Explain to somebody who doesn't ever think about Africa.
Mm-hmm.
As we think about certain key areas of the world as being strategically important to the United States and also as threatening to the United States, mm-hmm. and as allies of the United States. Africa is kind of this nebulous thing that sits out there on the eastern Atlantic. Why? Is there a strategic... What is the strategic interest that the United States has in Africa?
Yeah, so you know, on the national security side, there are... As we've pounded terror groups in the Middle East, they're starting to pop up in other parts of the world, and in particular in Africa. There are Al-Qaeda and ISIS-type groups throughout parts of West Africa. There's Al-Shabaab in the east. There's now Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. And these are global extremist groups that are organized, and they intend to attack our allies and to spread that ideology. And that's where we have to absolutely work with our allies to try to contain that. But on the positive side, and I think more of a reason that Africa is relevant to America, is that it's one of the regions of the world that is growing really fast. And, you know, we think of Africa as poor, but we're actually seeing millions and millions of families every year moving into the middle class. And if you think of something from the 1930s, I've got a picture in my house of my grandfather and grandmother standing in front of our family's first ever car. Mm-hmm. Well, that amazing transition is going on right now for millions of families in Africa, and that creates huge opportunities.
And, of course, there are big changes in Africa, particularly in Zimbabwe. We'll talk about that, the turnover of power from Robert Mugabe and other things with our guest, Dr. Todd Moss, when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest for the rest of the show is Dr. Todd Moss, Senior Fellow at the Center for Global Development, concentrating on Africa, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of African Affairs at the United States State Department. And we're talking about Africa and many other things here this morning. You testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee on how our involvement in helping to spread modern energy access in sub-Saharan Africa promotes U.S. economic and security interests. That might surprise some people. How does that promote our economic and security interests?
Well, you know, we all take 24/7 electricity and energy for granted. We have it all the time, and it's fundamental to everything that we do, the way we live, the way we work, the way we communicate, the way we move around. But that's just not true for large parts of the world, especially in large parts of Africa, where they're still burning wood for cooking, and people don't have basic electricity. And so the United States, you know, a big part of the way that we grew out of poverty in the early 20th century was through electrification. That process is now going on in sub-Saharan Africa, and it helps our allies because it helps to make their economies stronger. It helps to create jobs in those economies, which mean that, you know, it helps to generate all of that prosperity that we need our allies to have so they can be more capable. But even more importantly, on the economic side, the U.S. is a global energy leader. We've got, the top technology. We've got wonderful technology and energy companies. And these are markets that are hungry for energy. And so the government, the U.S. government, has a real interest in trying to foster the international energy marketplace to create opportunities for American companies.
Your focus is energy, and you wrote an article in which you said the World Bank now has three benchmarks for measuring poverty. And those benchmarks deal with how much people – I'm going to really summarize here.
Sure, sure.
But those benchmarks deal with how much people make per day, and you suggest that we should also measure poverty in terms of how much energy people can consume.
Absolutely, absolutely. So sometimes you may hear that there are a billion people around the world that live without access to electricity, and that's true. But the way that that's measured is at a very, very basic amount. So it's that means that a billion people don't have enough electricity for a couple of light bulbs and to charge their cell phone. We're not talking about having refrigerators and computers and all of that. But what is natural is that once people get a little bit of access to electricity, they want a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
And once you have a refrigerator, you want it to run all the time. So just like with income, you grow out of poverty, maybe you become lower middle class, you aspire to higher levels of income. That's natural and virtually universal. That's also true with energy.
With the advent of the cell phone, cell phones proliferated throughout the Third World very quickly, when you think about it. And it's partially because they didn't have telephones before because they didn't want to build the infrastructure required for telephones, which were wires and poles. How is electricity expanding? Are they building a grid, or is it solar and wind in individual little areas?
You know, it's just like here in the United States, all countries pursue all of the above. So we are seeing a lot of countries, especially in the rural areas where the grid is maybe a decade away, they are jumping ahead and doing off-grid, particularly off-grid solar for homes. So we are seeing rapid expansion, particularly in a place like East Africa, where that's exploding. At the same time, Africa is mostly urban, and it's becoming more urban.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. And cities still need old-school grids, and they're still going to need large-scale power to make the office. You know, you have to power air conditioning in office buildings. Mm-hmm. You've got to power factories. And right now, that's going to require a whole mix of energy, just like we have
here. So what kind of help does the U.S. provide? Has the U.S. traditionally provided, and how has that changed, if at all, under the Trump administration?
Well, the Trump administration hasn't really decided what they're going to do yet, okay. In part because the people that would decide what we would do haven't been nominated to positions yet. But
there are career holdovers doing
that. There's kind of continuing what was going on before, but no big decisions. But actually, President Obama, who I did not work for, actually launched a very, very interesting initiative back in 2013 called Power Africa. And what it is he tasked a number of federal agencies to do what they could to spur private investment into the power sector in Africa. And this includes some technical advisors that they would put in particular countries to try to spark private capital to come into those markets. And it's been very, very successful. I'm hopeful that the Trump administration will at least allow that to continue, but we'll have to wait and see.
There's an agency called OPIC. I'd never heard of them before yesterday.
Right, not the oil cartel.
Right, this is OPIC, O-P-I-C, the
that's
Overseas
right.
Private Investment Corporation. Is that what you're talking about?
So no? That's part
that's
of
part
Power.
Of it?
That is part of Power Africa. OPIC's a really interesting agency. No one's heard of it. It's tiny, but what it does is it helps make loans to American investors in very, very risky markets to help mitigate that risk.
So the Trump administration, early on in its existence, put that on the chopping block. Their original budget proposal called for closing that agency, and it's been a self-sustaining agency. U.S. taxpayers do not foot the bill for it at all, and it's contributed, evidently, $3.7 billion toward deficit reduction over the last decade. So if I understand this correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, I learn a lot just shortly before the guests arrive. After that budget proposal, President Trump went ahead and nominated Ray Washburn to head the organization. Has he taken over? Where does that agency stand now? Has funding been restored? Or not funding, but has, well, it has to have had some funding because it was in the budget.
Well, it's in the budget, but it's in the budget. This sounds strange, but it's in the budget as a negative item.
Okay.
So Mr. Washburn has taken over OPIC. There's a little bit, you know, this White House is a little bit schizophrenic. They say different things at different times. So their original proposal was to close the agency, but then they nominated a very close friend of the president who's a very prominent Texas businessman to run the agency. So I don't think it's going anywhere. If anything, I think we'll see it get bigger.
It's kind of a chicken and an egg thing, it would seem to me, energy and growing energy in Africa, because the cost of living may be low, but the pay scale is incredibly low. And if you can't pay for energy, they can't afford to build the infrastructure to bring you the energy. How does that happen? I mean, does somebody have to take a risk and build it and they will come? How does it happen?
Yeah, so look, it's like any normal economic growth projection where you've got a little bit of push and pull. What's clear now is that a lot of Africans are paying, are there, the demand for energy is very high, and we know that because many, many Africans pay extremely high rates, over $1 a kilowatt hour, because they're running diesel generators. If you can replace that with either cheaper solar or cheaper on-grid natural gas-fired power, you're going to see huge cost savings.
Robert Mugabe, Zimbabwe's longtime dictator known for destroying the nation's economy, his nation's economy, and for his ruthlessness, was recently ousted by the military there, and the man poised to replace him, I'm going to mispronounce his name, Emmerson Mnangagwa.
Mnangagwa, pretty good.
Thank you. Was Mugabe's enforcer, known as the crocodile.
That's right.
Is that just trading one bad guy for another? And you said that you know that the U.S. trading one dictator for the other will not lead to stability, and therefore we should do something else. So...
That's right.
Help me out here.
I actually got my start in African affairs in Zimbabwe 27 years ago as a student there, so I've watched that country very, very closely. Look, Emmerson Mnangagwa was Robert Mugabe's right-hand man. Mm-hmm. He's now in charge. This is essentially a palace coup. I do not expect it to get much better in the short term, but the U.S., has a role to play in encouraging that country to move toward free and fair elections and getting that country back into the global economy.
And it's within our national interest to see that happen?
It is, absolutely, but it's also something that we could do at very, very low cost, right? So the U.S. government can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can deal with the Middle East. We can also try to promote democracy and human rights in a place like Zimbabwe. That's what the American people would expect. I'm hopeful that the administration will come around and play an aggressive role there.
A couple of emails here before we move to your books. Dennis emails, does your guest think that racism plays any part in the appearance that our nation generally ignores Africa? I don't know that you agree that we ignore Africa. Do we?
Well, I don't think that the United States gives Africa the credit or attention that it deserves, and I think the historical legacy of racism absolutely plays a role there. But I think that's changing very rapidly, and in large part because of the incredible African diaspora that we have in the United States, which has really started to change the image of Africa here. Among regular people that, you know, have never been to Africa or don't think about it, they're starting to interact with, the Nigerian or Ghanaian or South African communities that are in every American city.
And Richard on Facebook has a comment that relates back to something we talked about earlier. Diplomacy, he says, has been used for years and nothing has been accomplished, as everyone can see. I know that you would disagree with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the front line for the United States is actually our civilian diplomatic corps and our development workers around the world. And if we are just going to ride back on the military only, we're going to see our soldiers in harm's way everywhere. And that's, I don't think, anything we want to see.
So we've talked about some fairly serious stuff here.
Yes.
Today. You are a fiction writer, and a successful one at that, because you have not one book. You just didn't do this last night and publish a book. You have five to your credit, and it's a series based on a fictional State Department crisis manager named Judd Riker. The fifth book just came out, The Shadow List. What's the premise behind all these works?
Yeah, so
it's the Golden Hour, Minute Zero, Ghosts of Havana,
and The
Shadow List.
That's right.
So there's four of them.
That's right. So, you know, when I left government, I really wanted to write a book about how dysfunctional our government is and how difficult it is to get good foreign policy. And I just decided it would be a lot more fun for me, and I would reach a wider audience if I did it as a thriller. I like to read thrillers on the beach. I think a lot of people do, to take a break from real life. I created this character, Judd Riker. He's crisis manager inside the State Department, and he thinks he's very clever, but the bureaucracy is eating him up.
We have a local author who has great success, Kathy Reichs, who is a forensic anthropologist and wrote a lot of papers about forensic anthropology, very detailed. And you write a lot of detailed, serious papers on foreign affairs and international relations. She was very successful in her Kathy Reichs series of books, which became the basis for the Bones TV show. Mm-hmm. What's the difference in writing the very detailed papers that you write versus this fiction that you write?
well, fiction is just far more fun to write. It's very invigorating to write it when you've got the creative juices flowing. But I actually find that you can share much more through fiction because you just have to mask it. No one wants to sit down and read a history book, but you can slip in little things here and there and make it exciting.
And your talk today at the World Affairs Council luncheon is called Truth Stranger Than Fiction? Is that what is that the point you're trying to make, that you have to couch it in fiction, because if you wrote about it as reality, no one would believe it?
I think that's partially true. I mean, look, I decided one of the reasons to write fiction and to write about serious issues like coups, like international terrorism through fiction is that you can reach a wider audience and you can also take people inside the White House Situation Room or inside an embassy overseas to hear how officials debate what should the U.S. do and why does it go so badly so often. I just think that accessibility makes it much more attractive than a nonfiction book, which people don't often like to read.
These have been described, your books have been described by the New York Times and others as page turners. So if you want to know how the State Department works and inside the government works, and you want to get a belly full of it, you can try his books, The Golden Hour, Minute Zero, Ghosts of Havana, and The Shadowless. Dr. Todd Moss, who's speaking today at the World Affairs Council Charlotte Luncheon, Senior Fellow at the Center for Global Development. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mike. Great to be here.